Oh, hey, I'm glad you're here. If you're listening to this at the time it's released, then I must be dead. I'm just kidding. So many movies have those recordings from beyond the grave. All right, I'm getting sidetracked already. It's the final week of October, which is a prime time for us to talk about being scared. As a kid growing up in a video store, fear came in the shape of VHS tape. Someone made that shirt. Some of the cover art would pop back up in my dreams. I have vivid memories of tracing images of a dream to Berserker, the Nordic Curse, where in the sky there's like an oil painting style face just screaming, this like scream of madness. It was quite haunting stuff. Or Demon of Paradise, which one of the versions has this mer-demon creature at the top with so many sharp teeth, and the tagline was, "He's been asleep for 1,000 years. To which I always feel like they should have added in, "Now he's awake." Otherwise that really just sounds pleasant. Like, especially as a parent, I would take 1,000 minutes, which is about 16 hours, but I would still take it. It's a bit greedy, I'll admit that. And of course, Maniac. And no, not Maniac Cop, which is about a maniac cop. I mean Maniac. No, not Invisible Maniac, which is about a problematic 80s comedy, about as problematic as you could get. No, not 2001 Maniacs, which is about 8 college students fighting off 2001 Maniacs. No, I'm talking about Maniac Cop 2. Just kidding. What if I just listed off Maniac movies for the rest of this? No, not Maniac, starring Jonah Hill on Netflix. But I'm talking about the original Joe Spinell vehicle, Maniac. The cover just lets you know that you're probably not ready to feel this gross. Eventually, I would learn not to fear them, and I would just enjoy the ride. And I still do. I mean, because you never know when you're going to meet your eventual demise. Whoa, dark turn. Dirk talks about actual death. For instance, you go in for a checkup and you're told that the knot in your neck is in fact a 400-year-old witch doctor fetus who wants to be reborn. Wait, what? And just like that, we're brought to today's episode in the smoothest transition possible. The film is The Manitou. The guest is a tarot reader and designer of tarot decks, and this is VHS. Hello and welcome to VHS. I'm your host, Dirk Marshall. Links to the topics of the conversations are always posted at the website vh-us.com. You can interact with me on Instagram at vh.us or vhs_podcast on Twitter. Feel free to reach out, complain, concerns, recommend movies, etc. I'm joined in the studio by Coleman Stevenson, who is an artist, writer, tarot practitioner, and owner of The Dark Exact, a company that specializes in tarot and other tools for self-study. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited about this.
All right. People can find more about you on your website, ColemanStevenson.com. You are Dark Exact on Instagram and Dark Exact on Twitter. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Fantastic. The reason I'm joined by Coleman Stevenson is because we're brought together by the film The Manitou. At the time of this recording, the film can be found at Movie Madness. The Blu-ray is out by Shout Factory. The DVD is available from VHSPS, which is what I loaned you to watch, and I really like that format, because what this service, VHSPS, does is they take movies that are stuck on VHS and they convert it to DVD under the guise that you already own the movie, so you're just buying a transfer of something that you previously own. So it's not illegal per se, but one of my favorite things they do, other than making chapters for the film, is they put a song during the title screen. And the song that they put for The Manitou is Manitou by a band called Classics Nouveau. Which is a very obscure 80s band. And I became infatuated with this weird Manitou song when I got this DVD. And I looked for it, but all I could find was the heavy metal band Venom has a song called Manitou.
Is it a cover?
No, they're two different Manitou songs, and I don't know. It's pretty fascinating, but my brother-in-law, Dave, shout out to Dave, he Shazammed it when I was showing him this film, I think this year, and Classics Nouveau popped up, so we dove deep into Classics Nouveau, and they don't have a video for Manitou, but there's a video for, I believe it's called Guilty, and we're going to put that up at bh-us.com. You got to see this band, the singer, it's all wild, and it would fit totally with this movie. I wish that they were on the soundtrack, but sadly they're not. But if you get that copy of the DVD, there it is. The synopsis is a psychic, played by Tony Curtis, recruits a witch doctor, Michael Ansara, to get a 400-year-old Indian medicine man off his girlfriend Susan Strasberg's back.
That's literally off her back.
Yes, that's the synopsis for the movie The Manitou. Was this a first-time watch for you?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, great.
I had never heard of this film.
Fantastic. And as somebody who is a tarot practitioner, do you see a lot of portrayals of tarot? Do you see any films that you're like, oh, I'm watching more tarot content?
It's definitely out there. Yeah. A lot of times you see them just used as props or character development pieces more than actually having the cards become a part of the story.
Right.
But it all different versions of this exists. I'm totally blanking on the name, but there was a recent, I think it was an Amazon series, maybe. It was either Amazon or Netflix, where every episode was connected to a different major arcana card. So that's probably a, you know, far to the other end.
Right.
But everything in between and tons of misrepresentations.
Right.
Of the cards. I would say probably, and we do see it in this film too, but probably the number one use, and I don't know if this is statistically accurate,
sure.
But
well, what you've
just
seen.
In my experience, the number one use of tarot as any kind of a plot point is the death card coming up, but to indicate actual death, which is not what that card means in the context of the tarot, but you see that over and over and over again in movies.
Right. And you said arcana? What was the word you
Major
said?
Major arcana?
Yeah, what is that exactly?
So a classic tarot deck is divided into two main parts. Mm-hmm. There's the major arcana and the minor arcana. Arcana means secrets.
Oh, okay. So
the major arcana cards are the big archetype cards, the ones that you probably most have heard of when people talk about the tarot.
Yeah.
The Fool, the Magician, the Tower, Death, the Devil, those named cards. And then the minor arcana are the four suits of the tarot. So depending on the deck, cups, swords, pentacles or coins, and then wands or rods, batons. There's lots of different names for the suits depending on the age of the deck. But the major arcana deals with those, the big life ideas,
okay,
phases, changes. The minor arcana are more like daily dealings. So just that, just stuff of daily experiences, trials and tribulations, and successes as well. But each suit represents a different aspect of, or different realm of existence. So like cups are emotions. I'm oversimplifying, but cups are emotional realm. Wands are, they can be like spiritual or that just like the kind of drive for doing your works in the world. Pentacles are material concerns, physical things, financial things. Swords are mental realm. So analysis, thinking, communication.
Wow. And that's so funny because we only really see like five cards usually in movies. Like it's just, oh, okay.
And like in this one, they're not even discussed. They just represent like a little moment of uh-oh.
Yeah. Yes. First, we'll talk a little bit about the players in the film. The director is William Girdler.
Yes, it is.
Started with Three on a Meat Hook in 72, Asylum of Satan in 72. The Get Man, a.k.a. Zebra Killer in 74, Abby in 74, Project Kill in 76, Grizzly in 76, Daily Animals in 77, Manitou, 78, and then sadly, he died.
Yeah, tragically.
Tragically dies in a helicopter scouting a location before Manitou ever actually was seen. So he never got to see his final opus, which is, it's a bummer. But good old Billy G.
If we're establishing a little context, can I mention one thing that people may not know about him that I think is interesting and very connected to this film, and something that is also connected to tarot that I hope we can talk about?
Yes, please.
That many of his films were blaxploitation films.
Well, yes, that's true. Abby, which was like the Black Exorcist, is what people said a lot of times. Sheba Baby, definitely. Was Project Kill? I didn't see Project Kill.
I don't know. I have not actually seen any of these. I was just doing a little bit of background research so that I could understand how to read this movie.
Right, right.
Because I think that it's a very problematic film.
Yes, there are some things that, very different. Say now than 1978
absolutely.
Or 77, depending on what you see on the internet.
So I hope we can talk about that a little bit.
Of course.
It's fascinating.
Yeah. I don't really know much about his way he got into cinema, the history of William Girdler. The Manitou was probably the first movie. No, Grizzly was the first movie I ever saw of his. Then I kind of worked around. I mean, there's only 9, so doesn't take long to track most of them down. Abby is the one that's the hardest to find, because when it was released, the company that had The Exorcist went after them.
Oh, that makes sense.
So they were allowed to keep their, I think it was like the opening weekend or something, if they pulled the movie from theaters, which they did.
Wow.
So it's very tricky to find that film.
I would be interested to see it.
I think
it
just,
as well.
It just played a film festival. People were super excited to get to actually finally see a print of it, but whether it'll ever be out in Blu-ray or DVD, I don't know. Probably not. Someone's going to pay enough, I'd imagine, at some point, but we'll see.
But 9 films only, but 9 films before the age of 30 is quite a feat.
It's pretty crazy, and I think as a director, he puts together films that are very entertaining and interesting. It's very tricky. I think The Manitou, which we'll get to, was written in 3 days because it was put into production under the guise they'd already written it.
Wow.
Yeah. So it's pretty crazy. It is based on a book series. I'm sure we'll get to that.
Have you read the book?
I haven't. It's very hard to find the books.
Okay.
For sure. The cinematographer is Michael Hugo. A lot of TV in the 60s and 70s. Manitou in 78, Gorp in 80. And then more TV. Dynasty, Heart to Heart, and Melrose Place. All the episodes of Melrose Place by the cinematographer of Manitou.
That's an interesting progression of a career.
Pretty great. The writer, Graham Masterson. The Manitou was his first original book. I know you are currently working on a new book.
I always have a couple in the works. I'm working on a collaborative book of spreads for the tarot with a bunch of other tarot readers. And then I am in the process of revising for a second edition for my tarot guidebook.
Awesome. What was the name of the first guidebook?
The Dark Exact Tarot Guide.
Great. You can find that at darkexact.com.
There's actually no darkexact.com
yet.
I need to...
Does someone else have the rights to it?
No, I have it.
Okay.
I just, I'm not super web savvy. I have an Etsy shop, which is where I do most of my
then
direct sales.
Find Dark Exact on Etsy.
Thank you.
Yes. Previously, Graham Masterson wrote several sex therapy books under the names Jan Berghoff, Edward Thorne, and Angel Smith. After a massive success, he changed to write them under his own name. Some of those books are Women's Erotic Dreams and What They Mean, How to Be a Perfect Lover, How to Drive Your Man Wild in Bed, and How to Drive Your Woman Wild in Bed.
We should do another episode where we analyze Manitou from that angle.
Yes.
Actually, I'm realizing now.
I'm shocked after those he didn't write Whoa Manitou, you know? he did 5 Manitou books, eventually Jin, I don't know if you pronounce the D there, for his book series, where Tony Curtis's character in the movie makes a return.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Hmm. Pretty interesting. The editor is Bud Asman, only edited Girdler's 9 films, then moved to sound editing, but listen to the films that he did sound editing for. Nighthawks, Conan, First Blood, The Last Starfighter, Red Dawn, and New Jack City, just to name some of them. Yeah, it's crazy. Like, he did the editing for these 9 films and then switched over to some of the biggest sound editing films at the time.
It's goodness.
Pretty amazing. The actor, Tony Curtis. Sweet Smell of Success in 57, Some Like It Hot in 59, Operation Petticoat in 59, and at this rate we'd never get to Manitou in 78, but if you don't know who Tony Curtis is, just pick any part of his career and watch it, because he's Tony Curtis. It's pretty incredible. He continued to work until 2008. The next actor we have is Susan Strasberg. She's the daughter of Lee Strasberg of the Actors Studio. Saying she had a long career would be quite an understatement, as she was in the first TV sitcom which aired in color, called The Marriage. She was in the films Mystery at Malibu in 76, Roller Coaster in 77, Manitou in 78, Beggar Man Thief in 79. Our second leading man in the film is Michael Ansara, a ton of TV in the 60s and 70s. He was in It's Alive in 74, Day of the Animals in 77, Manitou in 78, did a lot of voice work, including 3 of the last Batman video games. He plays Mr. Freeze. So, there you go.
Patient is a female Caucasian, 28 years of age, no previous record of tumorous growth.
We start with the x-ray of the spine, and we're introduced to the battle between science and mysticism, which we'll wrestle throughout the rest of the film.
It's right there in my notes as well.
Yeah.
Theme.
It's very like, this is what we're going to have. Two doctors that are perplexed in this office. We jump right to the lump, and the baffled doctor's in an office. The first plays Dr. Hughes, and that's John Cedar. He co-wrote the script with Girdler in 3 days. One of my favorite bits of dialogue in this scene is one doctor says,
"I wish I knew what the hell we were dealing with here. You know, I've been through every tumor book I can find."
Which is just a great sentence on its own. But then John Cedar, who co-wrote the script, says to him,
"Bob, I wrote the books and I don't know what the hell it is."
"I know, Bob, I wrote the books." Which is so great. That back and forth, I was just like, this first time I watched it, what's happening in this movie? And then they're standing in front of this poster of fetuses, and the guy looks at it, he's like, "It's wild, right?" He's like, "I don't know." And you're just like, "What am I watching?"
It's really crazy. Yeah, it's crazy.
We then get a lovely shot of San Francisco, just to let you know where it's set. We see a skull candle, and the camera passes an interesting apartment, coming to a woman in a crazy hat, and bam, Tony Curtis. There he is, in an amazing robe, with a fake mustache, reading tarot.
"That's rather interesting. Thursday gas, indigestion. Probably something that you're going to eat."
"Oh, no."
I love that moment where he takes his mustache off. Sorry if I'm jumping too much. But, because, of course, you could think it was real
initially. Yeah.
And then the second the client leaves, you know, he pumps up
sticks it to the
dance
wall.
Music and takes a mustache off. Yeah, sticks it to the wall.
What did you think of his tarot intro here?
I kind of like his reading setup.
Nice, yeah. You know, it's got a nice crystal light situation there in the background.
Well, there's just the kind of separateness, right? Like the space that's reserved for reading.
He does say, like, "Welcome to Earth" or "Welcome to the world" or whatever when he opens the curtain and turns the light on.
Yeah. So there is, actually, I have to say, in a general sense, where tarot is concerned in this film, I was pleasantly surprised at what I would say is, a certain amount of accuracy or at least plausibility in the setup. Now, he is obviously presented as a charlatan of a sort.
Yes.
So I'm not talking about that aspect, but he creates the ritual space. He brings people in and out of that zone. So that kind of threshold crossing is
like
there.
They've shown some respect.
Which
is interesting.
Some of the things I do.
Yeah, because they are also, I feel like he is at battle, sort of. Like, he stands up for his charlatanism, but at the same time, he seems to be struggling with it because he's faced with this giant witch doctor tumor situation that, I mean, science can't explain it. He can't explain it. And he keeps going back to his cards. So it's a very interesting character.
Well, and his magic is working. I mean, it kind of is implied almost that Manitou is what makes the
that we all have Darrow Manitou work. Yeah, Manitou is in everything.
That kind of great spirit. I think it's problematic to apply terms that come from native culture to something that's a European form, but that just that idea that there is possibly something that makes the cards work. So even in those moments where he is maybe pushing away his authentic connection to those things, mm-hmm. the cards that come up for his sitters are full of relevant information.
Yeah, it's very interesting.
Yeah, he's certainly passing himself off as the magician with his jacket is covered in zodiac and planetary symbols.
It's almost like they're saying he's the like the huckster or whatever, but the process isn't the thing that's in question.
Yeah. And within that, I think there are hints that he can actually do it.
Mm-hmm.
He certainly knows the cards. He knows what they mean because you see his reaction when difficult cards come up that he doesn't want to talk about with his clients.
Mm-hmm.
So he uses the tarot to do these ridiculous predictions, which is not how tarot, in my opinion, is not how the cards should be used.
Like
that's
crazy because that's my next question.
Yeah. He predicts that...
You just predicted my question.
Imagine that. I must be a tarot reader.
There it is.
Something will fall on her foot.
Yes.
She will get gas and indigestion from something that she eats.
Yep.
Like he's doing all of these kind of silly sort of predictions that most tarot readers these days would laugh at.
I was going to say, because he's predicting the future, and I would say, is that the function of tarot usually?
It is not exactly what I would say. I mean, people are always wanting to look at what might be coming up.
Got it.
But my belief with the tarot and the way that I use it with clients and for myself is it's more for self-study. So I'm equally interested in what is happening now, and anything that's forward looking in the spreads that I would use would be thinking about like consequences of my own actions.
Okay.
Like if nothing changes in current problematic behavior, this could be the result, or they could be more suggestion cards for, you know, what should I do to move through this, or what should I do to keep on a positive path with whatever else is showing up in the cards. So it's really more about externalizing problems or questions that are happening within so that you can get a more clear perspective. It makes it a little bit more objective, so that you can look at it, get it out of yourself, get it out of that churning place and just actually examine, what some of the inner workings of the problem are.
Mm-hmm.
When I go to the cards, I'm not looking to see which day something is going to fall on my foot. So the way that he interacts with his clients, not really what I'd be looking for doing tarot with people.
Well, that's, I think, the difference between the tarot and the reader. Right.
Yeah.
Like his style, you know, my next thing I had down was that my favorite prediction is that he says she'll have gas on Thursday from something that she ate. And from what you said at the beginning, which card would that be?
We couldn't see it in that reading.
Yeah.
I tried to look always. So like I've pulled right here for us the reading that he gives Karen. But
yes.
With that one, that would be...
The cups? Which card? What area are we?
Oh, goodness.
It's the smaller of the...
It could be any of the cards that are about some kind of obstacle.
Yeah.
You know, like
and
it could be a seven of wands or a nine of wands.
Okay.
Or, there's not going to be a...
Gotcha. There's no gas card.
For predicting gas. Hmm. But in the history of the tarot and any kind of cardomancy or divination with cards of any kind... there are older styles where people are doing much more of this kind of fortune tellery reading, where, you know, in 1 year's time you will meet a, you know, tall, dark, handsome man, you know, that kind of reading, or you will lose your great fortune. You will, you know, it's, it's just not really the contemporary style of reading, but a lot of the stuff that he does, like he, with Miss Hertz or whatever her name
something
is,
like that.
He has her interact with the cards before he pulls them.
And oh, the
she's
second
so
lady.
Funny. Yeah. The second lady, she just does this quick tap. Little tap,
yeah, yeah,
which I thought is great because there are varying opinions on how people should, right. or, you know, if people even can put their energy into the cards. Yeah. So a lot of people have the person that they're reading for shuffle the deck, for example. So that was her version. You know, she interacts just a little bit. Certainly it put her personality into it.
Yes.
And, you know, then they're choosing in that moment a signifier card for her. Mm-hmm. So a card to represent her in the reading. Sometimes those can be drawn randomly, but they can also be selected. And oftentimes when they are selected, they're selected from the court cards. Mm. And so he's asking her, you know, which queen does she want to be?
Right.
Do you want to be the queen of swords? And she's like, no, because the queen of swords is too rigid and practical for her. They go through this whole thing with the queens and she wants the queen of wands, which is this passionate kind of,
that's how I see myself.
Character, yeah. Which is interesting for that woman.
Yeah.
But I also, just to go back to that mustache for 1 second.
Oh, we're right at that point.
Okay. There is something I love about that because all of his artifice,
mm-hmm.
all of the performance that he puts on, I can kind of read as protective gestures.
Oh, right. Yeah.
So, you know, let's say he was taking this seriously. Those could be things that he does in order to create a boundary between him and the sitter, mm-hmm. the querent, because, you know, the reading is, it's about them and what makes them buy into the experience.
Right.
But also, you know, just doing these things to sort of block the energy of the other person. I know a lot of readers who do things like that to protect themselves or to keep themselves out of what's happening with the cards.
Yeah, so that's, I mean, it looks, it's such an interesting film because it looks like they're being like, oh, he's like a charlatan scam artist. And some people do say that to him, but he also is very defensive of the cards and what he does.
Yeah.
And there are some interesting, like, aspects that perhaps when the book was written, you know, that's what the movie's based off of, even though they wrote it in 3 days, they kept a lot of the original content of the film, then changed a lot of select things. But as you touched on, he turns the lights on, ushers her out, gives her a specific mantra.
It's a God well the fruit for the pips will grow again. Yes, every morning without fail.
And then we see his crazy disco neighbor in the hallway.
Oh, God, Harry, that routine is getting cornier every day.
Yeah, I heard yours last week. Yours is too.
He closes the door, gets a beer, turns on the disco, gives us a shimmy, and that's our leading man introduction. It's pretty fantastic.
It's pretty great. It's such a good scene.
Yeah.
I love that scene.
Well, and I was like, I was already into the movie, but then when that happened, I was like, I'm all in on the Manitou. Like, I don't know where this movie is going. And I couldn't have known, actually, to be honest. But I wanted to hang out with him for sure.
Erskine speaking, reader of tarot.
Harry, this is Karen. Harry, are you busy?
Harry receives a call from Karen, and they go to meet in a park. They spend the day together and then return to his apartment, and after showering and putting on robes, because I'm guessing they got caught in the rain.
They got caught in the rain.
Yeah, the first time I watched it, I was like, what is happening now? He consults the cards again. And he gets the death card.
Okay, here we go.
So he reshuffles, and it happens again.
Well, what does that mean?
I know what it means, but I did not want to be doing it.
My question for you is, why are some cards in a straight row and some of them laid across?
Okay, so we don't know what spread it is that he was using.
Yeah.
But usually
a spread is a deck or
okay. So a spread. I can tell you what deck and everything he was using.
Oh, okay.
But the spread is the way you lay the cards out. So a spread is a predetermined positional thing. So okay. It tells you you're going to put a card here first.
Like a formation?
Yeah. Okay. And that's going to give you context for that card. So you'll be reading that card, but then you'll also be thinking of it as, say, this is the card for the past. And then the next card is the card for the present. And then there's a card for the future.
Got it.
And there's tons and tons and tons of spreads for tarot. Starting with very simple, small spreads up to just a table full of cards. So with that, sometimes if a card is laid across, turn the other way, laid across mm-hmm. another card, it's said to cross it. So it's forces that are impacting the card beneath
okay.
is one way that occurs sometimes in tarot reading. But there could be other ways. It just depends on what the spread, how the spread is done.
Yeah.
So I don't know what spread he was using, but I pulled the cards that came
okay,
up.
Okay, great.
It's even more dramatic than what you just described. So it's the Tower, the Moon, the Devil, and the Death card, and they all are from the Rider-Waite-Smith deck, which is a deck that was created in 1910, but continues to be very popular today and exists in lots of different versions at this
point. Seems like what I've seen in most movies.
Yeah, that's
the same
I would
images.
Say that's the most common one that pops up in media like that. Sometimes also the Crowley-Toth deck shows up. But definitely the Rider-Waite-Smith is the most commonly used in those kind of things because it is, like, in many people's ideas, the quintessential tarot deck, even though it certainly isn't. But so those cards, they all come up, and then he reshuffles and lays them out again, and every one of the same cards comes up in reverse, meaning upside down.
Oh.
So it's very impactful. So every tarot reader watching that would be like, what is
yeah.
happening? Which is why he has the reaction that he does.
But that's not explained at all in the movie.
No, you have to know about tarot
yeah.
in order for that to be a meaningful thing.
That's such a weird plot point.
And I was so shocked to see that because I mean, it's something that tarot readers talk about a lot. We joke about it a lot. When a
What's
card you don't want to see, oh, that's a whole other thing.
Oh.
But just when a card that you don't want to really see in a spread and you try to ignore it and then it just keeps coming again and again and again every time you pull the cards. So reversals, not everybody reads reversals, but there is a way of reading that if a card appears upside down when you lay it out, that you would read it in a different way. There's a whole set of traditional meanings
mm-hmm.
for reversals, but then there's also different philosophies of that some people feel if it's reversed that it's a distortion of that card's energy or meaning
mm-hmm.
or like a delay, or it depends. Some people don't read reversals at all. So they just ignore
wow.
that, and however the card comes up, they're just always reading with the same traditional meaning, or they go off purely in intuition. So they're not worrying about that at all because they're just getting whatever the intuitive hit is off the card each
Got
time
it.
Freshly. I kind of look at both aspects. Like for me, every tarot card is almost like a little wheel. But yeah, it is interesting that they all came back reversed in when he redrew, because that also could be seen as the energy that fuels the card saying, I told you what the reading is. Don't deny
right.
that. Here's what you get.
Mm-hmm.
It's just kind of messing with him a little bit. So there's lots of different ways to analyze
yeah.
that scene. But yeah, basically pulled... That it's a four very challenging cards.
Okay. I mostly just saw the death one, so that's a
yeah.
wonderful
the
explanation.
Tower, so if we talk about the death, like, so I mentioned earlier that the death card is used all the time in movies to suggest that someone's going to die.
Yeah.
And it literally happens in this
oh, yeah.
film
yeah.
with that other character.
Mm-hmm.
He pulls it and then
yeah.
she floats down the hallway and
yes.
falls down the stairs and dies. But... sorry, spoiler. Ooh.
Oh, that's okay.
Okay.
That's all we do here.
Okay, great. But the death card is not about physical death. It's about personal transformation. It's a card about identity, about just really letting go of an old way of being and coming into the new. Usually there's a, you know, an element of, well, just like in death, it's like something has to decay and then fall away, and then the new life springs forth out of that. So the death card does not mean death.
But in this film, he might be thinking it does talk about death.
Probably, yes.
But however, it's probably talking about the...
Yes.
Oh, wow.
I thought that too. So, because she's going to give birth to this new life out of her, but also...
He also references that in the end.
But she goes through...
Yes.
All of the characters go through this kind of transformation too.
Yeah.
So it could be hinting at that. The card that in the spread that he pulls for her that's the truly dangerous card is the Tower. The Tower is the card that is representing huge change and everything that you believe in crumbling suddenly to bits.
Which kind of happens for all of them.
Yeah.
In one way or another.
I mean, certainly that's what it seems like is happening with her life as the film opens and progresses.
Yeah.
And then the Devil as well, which is the card of being, you know, chained to something, being in bondage, being kept down. I'm oversimplifying again.
Sure.
But what they're trying to suggest is that that's the dark forces that are coming to, that
her
they're going to have to fight.
Yes. then they're sleeping by the fire. Tony wakes up to hear her whispering, she whispers it a couple times. And the next day, she goes under the scalpel to remove the growth, and it does not go as planned.
Nope.
The surgeon scalpels his own wrist instead. And then we have the second visit, which you touched on, an elderly woman. He puts on the fake mustache and the robe. She taps the cards, just lightly.
Perhaps a little cloudiness, nothing too serious. Very nice. Look at that. And for you personally, I see some...
And then has the conversation that you just said about the queens, which, again, not knowing tarot, I knew nothing about. So that is really fascinating to know that she chose that specific queen. I wasn't even listening. Like, probably the first four times I watched the movie, because I just didn't think it was important. So then now having that piece of information, I'm like, oh my gosh. And then...
Yeah,
oh,
she
yes.
becomes possessed by it as well.
So as he's looking at the cards, she enters a trance and starts chanting. She goes into the kitchen. There's this crazy music swelling. Then one of my favorite images from the film is where she just... snaps sort of out of it. It looks like she just becomes very like prim and proper in her stoicism, goes to the door opens, she floats down the hallway, and the positioning of her hands for some reason is so creepy to me, because her arms are straight down at her sides, and then she goes down the stairs, and talk about transformation, her face transforms the rail of that staircase. Like, when she falls, her head just takes down, like, it's really strange. It's so bizarre. And then he runs, well, he sort of runs to her aid and cradles her in the stairway, but doesn't call for help? Or...
I think he's calling for help.
He's just, like, holding
her. Oh, he was on the phone with 911 already. That's right.
Okay.
Back in the... When she first starts acting strangely...
He makes a call.
Because when she comes in, she's sort of... a little hunched, and she has movement problems, and he seats her comfortably, and she relaxes in the chair. But when she stands up and starts doing all of this, she has no mobility problems.
Yeah,
she is.
It's intense.
Yes. Which could also link to that Queen of Wands. Like, she's suddenly filled with that fire of the wands.
Right.
I don't know. Anyway.
Oh, that's so good. He goes to see Dr. Hughes. They discuss that she's what she's saying in her sleep. They walk through this super cool hospital. The hospital in this film, it's so cool looking. He says, Panna Witchy Salitu to Susan Strasberg, and she starts screaming, Panna. And this was when I realized what perfect casting it was for her, because it's almost like Rosemary's Baby, where you just have a star that can give a look or extend their jaw in a way that, like, CG movies try to do it now, and it looks creepy, but when she opens her mouth and screams, it's disturbing. She looks like possessed in a way. We get some more shots of San Francisco because by now we probably forgot what city we're in. Harry goes to visit MacArthur and Amelia, who I don't know exactly what their role in the film is, other than that they have the aunt that does the
So she seance. Was his teacher. She's who taught him to read.
Okay, right. You would think with how many times I've seen this movie, I would understand that important Well,
I was really
of...
focused on
Yeah, no,
certain
that's
aspects,
so great. But... I really appreciate it. Okay, so that was there. I was also thrown off by her makeup, which seems like stage makeup.
Yes.
It's like pancake. Like,
yeah,
it's very intense.
Yeah, I noticed that as well. And the slight, I mean, again, of the era for sure.
Sure,
but
yeah.
The slight stereotypical gypsy style of dress that... It's not heavily played up in that character, but hinted at
it's
for
hinted,
sure,
yes.
So that's problematic, but yeah.
Sharon's in trouble. She's scared and I want to help her.
But spiritual help?
What else have I got, Amelia?
I can't. I promised Mac, not anymore.
Amelia, you're the best. You taught me everything I know.
Harry Erskine, there's only one student I ever had who's worse than you, and he's a plumber.
They talk a bit about his relationship with Tarot, and what we don't know about is how he really started, but we also don't know how you started. So how did you find your way into Tarot and eventually having a business that makes its own book and deck, right?
Yeah, several decks.
Yeah.
I was always interested in things like this, certainly from an art perspective. I did not have anybody to teach it to me. This is not something that was passed down in my family. No one in my family did this. I didn't have friends who did it, so I would just go down to the south side in Birmingham where I grew up, and there were a couple of shops down there that had
are they still
decks.
Open?
One of them is, and then there's another one that is open now that wasn't there when I
What
was
are those
there.
Shops?
There was a shop called the Golden Temple, which is
awesome.
Still there. It's like a natural grocery store and cafe, and then they have
tarot,
all sorts of esoteric stuff.
Oh, cool.
And then there was another one, I can't remember, it was a tiny, tiny little boutique where I bought my first book on spells. Also, as the teenager. But I did not get a tarot deck then. I would just go and look at them and just wish it was for me.
Yeah.
But I felt that it wasn't because I always had this idea, and I think people still have this misconception that someone needs to bring you into the tradition, that it's this forbidden art. It certainly isn't. There's also a misconception that someone has to gift you your first deck. It's absolutely bullshit. So, yeah, it was not until, like, after college that I started reading for real. I had a neighbor who was into tarot, and we just started reading, and I wanted to learn. So I just learned casually by just doing readings with her, got my first deck, and... Then after studying for some time, started reading for other people, and it wasn't until this is about 5 years ago that I drew my first deck. I've always, I mean, I'm a writer as well, but my original creative form was visual art, which has always been present as well, and it also seemed an interesting way to combine both of those worlds of creation.
Cool. And how many decks do you have now?
I have the Dark Exact Tarot. That was the first one. And that exists in both a black and white version. The Vitriolic Tarot, which is a major arcana only deck that makes links between tarot and the alchemical process. And then I have the Personal Oracle, which is not a tarot. It's an oracle system. So looser structural system. And then I also have a series of Oracle decks that I've been working on. Each one is inspired by a different fairy tale. I also have a degree in folklore. That's what I did my undergraduate studies in. And so that's a nice way of also bringing that in. I did think it was interesting. His background, it's never stated. It's just sort of alluded to in multiple ways. Because also he and Karen
Right.
Apparently used to be in on it together.
Yeah.
And so that was important to me, although I don't think it got fully developed. I do feel like there was this hint that they were playing with things they shouldn't have been playing with.
Yep.
In the way that they were. That if they had taken it seriously and respected it, that maybe this would not have happened to them or something.
He says something along the lines of like, you once pulled the lights and or pulled the levers and flicked the lights or something.
Yep.
So, yeah.
Which is for people who don't know what that references. Signs. It references the fake seances from the late 1800s, that heyday of...
Which is the next scene. We get the seance. We get the crazy green lights, the awesome head effect rising
up
out of the center.
Out of the table. Amazing.
It's so good. They're communicating with the... we don't know his name yet, but the shaman, the from the other side.
Who are you? What do you want with Karen Candy?
Then a window explodes and lightning shoots out and splits the table in half. They said previously that this seance had to take place at Karen's house.
Yes.
So sorry about your table,
just
Karen.
Destroyed Karen's
That's
apartment.
So messed up. But no one's injured. They return to MacArthur and Amelia's place to do more research into the Native American shaman.
One quick thing about that lightning is the tower card very often, which came up
There's
in
lightning.
Karen's reading. There's lightning striking the tower and causing it to burn and crumble.
Wow.
So that was just an interesting
and
little...
And that definitely happens.
Yes.
And in this, it's such a great scene. When the head started rising up out of the table, I was like... If this movie, I mean, if it keeps getting crazier, this is going to be one of my favorite movies of all time. They read about the Manitou and then look up who the author is and then drive to the author's house, and it's Burgess Meredith. He is a fantastic actor. I love Burgess Meredith. Always amazing. He plays Dr. Snow, drops crazy knowledge that's super fascinating, and he's very hesitant to help.
I can't give you an exact translation. What was it? Title, Paddy Witchy Solitude. Well, I don't know, but it sounds to me like the language of the Piscataqua tribe.
But translate the phrase that we've been hearing to my death foretells my return.
Yes.
I think it's what he says.
Oh, that could mean something like, my death foretells my return.
My death foretells.
Dr. Snow. Is there any way to stop this medicine man or whatever it is before it kills her?
Anything for Burgess that you got in there?
I think that
he unpacks
he did
a lot of stuff.
A fun job of playing the distracted academic.
Yes. Yeah.
So I appreciated that. I also think it's very interesting. He is pretty much the only character. You know, he's this anthropologist. He's the only character who is excited to meet
Yes.
Miss Quamacus, the 400-year-old shaman, who very rightly so wants revenge
Yes.
for what has been done to Native peoples
Yes.
in the history of this country. So I think everyone else is like, how do we fight him? How do we fight him? Because, of course, they're only thinking about Karen's survival.
Mm-hmm.
On this very, you know, very micro concern level,
mm-hmm.
but larger things are at play here. And the professor is the only one who said, why would you want to destroy
like,
him? We have an opportunity to meet him and learn from him.
Yeah.
Professor, if this guy was so powerful, how are we going to fight him? I don't know. Why do you want to fight him? Why do you want to fight him, for heaven's sakes? Within 2 or 3 days, we could actually meet an Indian medicine man from a time far back in America's past. It seems to me criminal, sir.
So in the book, The Manitou, our book series, the a lot of things are more, what do you say, more graphically displayed.
Mm-hmm.
So the gore and stuff, it's way more bloody. The ways that Native Americans are portrayed is different. The history of, you know, white people and everything sort of, I mean, it's all played up a totally different way. So you have a lot more representation for the Native Americans and an understanding of what's going on. The hesitation of the help coming from Singing Rock is you know, it's books. So you have this ability to have all this stuff, and these four white guys had to rewrite it, the story, and crush it into an hour and 40 minutes.
They crushed it.
Yeah, so you missed a lot of that sort of things. Also, Michael Ansara's, I believe, Serbian.
He was born in Syria and of Lebanese descent.
Yeah.
So he is.
But this was the 70s, and he had been making a living
that hasn't stopped.
Native Americans.
Right.
Right.
But that we still do that. If someone is vaguely brown, then they get cast. And I mean, it's just.
Yeah. It's unfortunate for sure.
But also, can we just talk about this issue for a minute?
Yeah. Yeah.
Because I think that there's just a lot to unpack here with this film and the way, as you say, it all got kind of crushed in to make a Hollywood
hour
movie.
You
know. But still, there are choices within that. And there's this subtext running throughout this whole thing and the way that they constructed the plot. Like, so little things sprinkled in, right? Dr. Snow wants to meet the medicine man, but is spouting all kinds of stereotypical stuff about Native Americans. Harry, right in like one of the most tense scenes, actually has a moment to make fun of Native American use of herbs, saying
that, we get to that part.
I thought it was seasoning.
Yeah.
So there's just tons of little things like that sprinkled in. The fact that, of course, John Singing Rock wants to be paid in tobacco.
Yeah.
Well,
he asked for $100,000 for an education fund.
Yes,
and then for himself, he says, I don't know, I guess tobacco. I think it's supposed to seem like a selfless act, but it is a stereotype, yeah.
I know it becomes a sort of joke between the two of them in the film as
It's a weird use of humor.
It's, so a lot of the things that are sprinkled in that are supposed to be funny are extremely insensitive. But the thing that gets me the most is how the plot progresses and what the different characters' roles are in this. And this is what connects to me to the tarot in ways, too. All of this does problems with the tarot, at least. So Harry goes to John Singing Rock to ask for help.
Yes.
First off, the assumption that, of course, he's gonna help him because what's happening to Karen is gonna be so clearly important, right? So that's a strange thing as well. But also, how it progresses is that John Singing Rock's magic is insufficient against these beings, the Great Old One and the Star Beast that makes all the ice appear, and then Miss Kumakis himself. And so, you know, he's defeated and is gonna quit.
Yes.
And then Harry just refuses to get up.
Yes.
So the white man is now, you know, he's so removed from any kind of belief or whatever that he can just power through anything, and we're going to make this happen. And then Karen, of course, a white woman, is the one who ends up shooting laser beams and defeating Miss Kumakis in the void.
Yeah.
So, and then the John Singing Rock character ends up having to basically defer to the white guy hero because he's not powerful enough. There's that line. He says, you know, once when, you know, Harry is shown all this bravado about, we have to do this. He says, Harry, you still got room for a South Dakota Indian with a bag of tricks. It's just, oof.
Well, the problem with looking at a film in 1978 is that you really have to look at it in 1978.
It's true.
And
it's
that's
true.
Why a lot of 80s comedies don't work because they're real rapey and misogynistic.
Yes, however, they are a really interesting lens on the culture of that time. And so to go and look at something like this now, it just tells us so much about how people felt.
Yeah.
And I would argue that we have not exercised this.
No, not at all.
From our culture in any way.
Well, and there was such a pattern for, you take two different races, put them together, and how do they relate? They're going to make jokes about cliches, about the culture that the person's coming from. And that's like the humor of the time. It doesn't age well at all, but it's just something that was like, whether you're watching Lethal Weapon or anything, they're just like, you know, it's one of the films we covered in this season was Shoot to Kill, and that's a movie with Sidney Poitier and Tom mm-hmm. Berenger, and that movie actually skirts a lot of that. And it's just an action movie, but the way that it combines these two, you know, the white and the African-American characters, they do a lot of very clever things that aren't just portraying into the whole, like, you know, whatever racist thing you want to put in there to try to make a joke about cultures. Yeah. So there are some rarities, but for the most part, there's a lot of this kind of the seasoning joke and things like that.
There are, just within the world of tarot, there are a number of decks that have been made over the years that pull Native American symbolism.
Weird.
Not made by Native people.
Shocking.
Yeah. And they're awful.
Yeah.
They just are so exploitative, not only in the stereotypes that they promote, mm-hmm. but also in the fact that someone is, you know, making money off of
someone
else's culture and getting it wrong in the process, promoting the same type of ideas that we see in this movie from decades ago. So that's an interesting connection to tarot. There's been... there's currently this sort of renaissance of deck making and interest in tarot, and so many contemporary tarot deck creators are attempting to address issues of representation in the tarot, trying to do it in really positive ways. A deck like the Rider-Waite-Smith, which is what was used in the film, you know, everyone in the deck is white, which in the history of tarot is extremely common to find. And so lots of folks are working on changing that. But it's not just an issue. It's not just a matter of, you know, painting some people brown.
Sure.
It's about really making it work in a respectful way. There's also... more and more decks starting to come out by artists of color. There are decks that even take these older systems and reinvent them. Like some really awesome examples. There's the Black Power Tarot, which is I don't think that ever came out as a full deck. It's a majors only, at least the copy that I have is. Mm. It is a reinvention of the Marseille style deck. Using a really wide variety from like pop culture and just like the arts and social justice movements, mm-hmm. all these different African American figures.
What was that called?
Black Power Tarot.
Okay.
And so they're using the same card illustrations, but substituting these figures in. There's the Melanated Classic Tarot, which is a reinvention of the Rider-Waite-Smith deck. And then there's also, there's too many to name interesting things that are coming out now, but there's also the really gorgeous Dust to Onyx Tarot, which completely goes away with any old, you know, it's not an aping of Rider-Waite-Smith or a redoing of Marseille style. It's just absolutely gorgeous art. So anyway, people who are interested in how tarot is moving these days should look at those decks.
That's great. The next set piece we have, Harry dons an incredible outfit with a sweet reddish-brown jacket and a crazy wide collar that is barely buttoned. Apparently he can only button the bottom buttons of any shirt, and he returns to the doctor. They have a brief argument.
You and I have something in common, Karen Tandy, and the least you could do is try to save a life.
And then they go to where she's having a laser remove the tumor. The laser's going wild, just shooting everywhere. She's in the corner. It's just very disturbing. And
that was scary. She's just crouched in that corner like a wild animal.
It's like there's these it's just the positioning of like hands and body. It's very creepy. That's the creepy part of
it's
the film.
It's subtle though. I like that.
Yeah, very
about
subtle.
It.
And she says,
"He will kill you."
And then they sedate her. And then the doctor, in a conversation, says that the X-rays they've been using have mutated the shaman, and this is played up bigger in the book. That this technology has actually changed the shaman that's reemerging. So their technology has caused some kind of mutation. So not only is he coming back, but he's coming back in a weird mutated form. So, and I don't know what the subtext is that he's saying in the book, but it's just an interesting thing, I think, to note. Yeah, I wrote, the doctor says the X-rays may have mutated the shaman fetus, which is a sentence I've never said before. We then meet John Singing Rock, played by Michael Lanzara, covers the conversation we just had. He's hesitant. He's talking about putting his life on a line and just expecting that Singing Rock is going to do it.
I don't want your pleas for help, Mr. White Man. I don't need your money.
Yeah, right. And to go against essentially his own culture in order to do this.
Yeah.
For this one,
the guy, the
random
white guy,
stranger.
Yeah, it's very strange,
but there's that assumption that of course he will.
And he says like he's gonna think about it. They're both wearing amazing bell bottoms. There's some good takeaways from the scene. Exactly. Singing Rock says that he'll help if the money's donated to the Native American Educational Fund, and it's sort of like we covered earlier. Next, we get to see a trolley because, hey, it's San Francisco. Did you guys forget? They all don mustard yellow scrubs in one of my favorite moments where Singing Rock wears it for like half a second. It's like, why did they even have those on? They're not doing surgery. It's so strange. He just takes it off and gets right to business. He pours a salt circle around the bed and begins tapping bones.
I think it's sand.
Oh, sand.
I wondered about that, too. I thought, is it brick dust and salt? But that's another form of magic.
Right.
But I think at some point it's referred to as sand. I made a point of repaying attention to that, and I'm pretty sure
sand.
Two different colors of sand.
Okay. Miss Komakas is speaking through her, and it's pretty creepy.
Miss Komakas.
He says, I'm mightier than you, and there's some spooky stuff going on that I'm sure my editor will probably pull and put in here.
Leave the white little brother from the plains. Do not help them or die.
He says, Miss Quamacus is the most powerful shaman of all time. So we have some more nature versus science stuff going on here. Tony Curtis is pacing away like a father awaiting a birth, and he kind of is.
Mm-hmm.
He's not the father, but something evil is about to be born. He peeks in, and there's a man keeping watch on Susan Strasberg. He's reading a book in the dark, which I think is pretty amazing. The only light is coming from the door Tony Curtis opens, and he's just... I was like, what? That's terrible for his eyes. Tony strolls around, displaying his nipples in a powder blue shirt, which... this movie has a lot of Tony Curtis nipple. If that's your thing, this is the movie. Then an orderly's bloody face breaks the glass. The window in the glass window in the door. Oh, it should be of note that while he's walking around in this powder blue shirt, he goes to the nurse and tries to do Alka-Seltzer.
Okay, I have a theory about that. Okay. Alka-Seltzer.
What's going on with the Alka-Seltzer?
Okay, so, because it's real, they take a strange amount of time.
Yes.
With that scene.
Yeah, the Alka-Seltzer goes in the water, and for those who haven't seen it yet, you should have watched the movie by now, but it doesn't work.
It doesn't fizz. Yes. But then, when we come back into that place later is when all of the fog and ice has erupted.
Right.
So I like to think that...
It's the start of that?
The star beast that they said made the ice used somehow the Alka-Seltzer too.
Okay. That's probably more effort than they...
Yeah.
But I really like that.
That was my way of insisting that it fit.
Right. So the orderly's bloody face breaks the window in the door. Singing Rock and Tony go in the room. Blood is everywhere. She's on all fours, the huge tumors on her back. And then we see tiny hands writhing under the skin, tearing out of the flesh. He rises out of her back, and the face looks like Mortis with the body of Danzig. And then he slithers around on the ground, and then he's a little person. And then he sits up all slimy, and I think there's a shot of his scrotum. There's something that flops in the part where he sits up, and they don't show him from the waist down for the rest of the movie. So I don't know if it's part of the costume, because he has a really crazy abdomen situation.
Totally missed that.
Yeah, well, in your third watching, maybe you'll see it. It's a crazy scene. Like, it's a crazy birth situation. It's definitely new territory and not something I've seen since. It's pretty fascinating. Time passes, and then we see an orderly sitting outside the door. So now the door's just open with Miss Kouamakas just kneeling at the bed. Miss Kouamakas is played by Felix Silla and Joe Geeb. Felix was in Planet of the Apes, Demon Seed, House, Spaceballs, Return of the Jedi, Batman Returns, and E.T. Pretty amazing actor. Joe started with The Manitou, then Howling Six, The Freaks, Weird Science, and Going Overboard. Both are still acting today.
Oh, wow.
So the two men that played Miss Kouamakas. Miss Kouamakas raises the dead orderly, and the good shaman douses him with some magic, and the zombie crashes to the floor. The shaman, Miss Kouamakas, is speaking through her, and the skin on her back is all gross. It's like...
No blood, though, when he comes out.
No blood.
How does that...
Well, yeah, he's real wet, but her skin, not so much. Mm-mm. So that is really interesting. Miss Kouamakas begins to break the salt seal. She says,
"You have defied me. You have hurt me. I feel pain."
He creates a hologram lizard that bites the doctor's hand at this point in the movie. So if you're listening to this and you haven't seen it, a tumor on a woman's back gave birth to a witch doctor who created a hologram lizard, and this all happened in this movie. It's amazing.
It really did just escalate.
Oh, yeah.
And escalate
just rakes it up. It's so absurd. Tony takes the doctor to his office, and Singing Rock stays to fight Miss Kouamakas solo.
Actually, I just had a thought, too, about that poor doctor...
Yeah.
Whose hand just keeps being the target of this.
Yeah.
Because in the first surgery,
mm-hmm.
The spirit takes control of the doctor and tries to have him cut his own hand off
trying
with
to
the scalpel
hurt him,
and then bites the hand again. But also just thinking about the doctor's hand as an instrument of science.
Yeah, yeah.
In this, wow.
Exactly. Yeah, the symbolism.
Yes.
It's pretty crazy.
Sorry, thank you. Tangent.
Tony returns to the floor. There's ice everywhere. It looks incredible. Even the nurse is frozen with her hand raised up, which is pretty cool. So the hospital's completely frozen. The nurse is frozen. I feel like if I didn't know this movie was written by four people in 3 days, I would say it was written by people playing the game where you write two sentences and then you fold the paper over and the next person reads that sentence and then folds it over because
like
the events...
Exquisite corpse.
Yeah, yeah, it's like so crazy. Her room is unchanged, however, but Tony finds Singing Rock on his knees where the shaman was, and the shaman is nowhere to be found.
What's happening?
What? A wall then explodes. The frozen nurse's head flies off. Miss Kouamakas is shooting snow, and I'm guessing feathers, at them, as it is very strange snow. Movie snow is some of my favorite types of snow. It's like paper and feathers. It's just all blowing around wildly. None of it's wet in any way. But anyway, they escape in the elevator, which I think we all know in the case of a fire or a shaman being reborn, you take the stairs.
That's exactly what I said.
Right?
You going in the elevator?
But yeah. I guess because it's technology, and there's the thing they're proposing is that Miss Kouamakas can't understand technology. It's pretty insulting. The entire hospital begins shaking intensely, which is amazing. Tony mentions that maybe the high-tech computer could be used to fight Miss Kouamakas.
What the hell are you going to do with my computers?
John, didn't you say that a machine has its own Manitou?
Yeah.
Suppose we took the Manitou of all the machinery in this hospital, turned it on all at once, and directed that energy toward the Mixman.
Tony and Singing Rock take the stairs, as they should. There's a funny line there where they're talking and...
Here, wear this.
What's this for?
Protection.
Oh, I thought it was seasoning. Go ahead.
And you're supposed to be like... What a weird time to try to be, but okay. Then they're back at the frozen floor. A red laser ball shoots out of her room. They look into the room, and there's just a void of stars and space. Miss Kouamakas is floating. The bed with Susan is floating. anyone in their right mind would be like, what's happening in this movie? And does the movie explain it? Yeah, not so much.
Do they say at any point that he's opened a portal? Or, I can't remember.
I mean, I've seen this so many times now, and I was clawing for something. The effects are insane.
Yeah.
The computer gets fired up, there's lightning. Still naked, Miss Quamacus is in space. The computer starts smoking. It explodes, killing the doctor. He needs his end. Then it seems like Miss Quamacus and Star Beast is as one. What's the beast?
So I wrote down that they said the Star Beast was what made all of that ice. I might have misheard that, but there was also the Great Old One.
Yeah.
But they were saying it was essentially like the devil.
Yes. Well, there's tons of lightning, and then Susan Strasberg sits up topless, and there's fireballs, lasers, a good 10 minutes that there's no words, and just fireballs and lasers and weird vector effects, orchestral music's playing. I did not know what was happening, but if you muted it, and you could put on most of My Life with the Thrill Kill Cults catalog, and it would fit right in with this. So I recommend Sex on Wheels off Sexplosion, or Cooler Than Jesus off Confessions of a Knife. It's just like, it's such a long sequence that I was like, anything throwing back to like sleazy 70s stuff, it's, you could just loop that in a disco, just that scene. We see the shaman was there, he's gone now. There's a slimy salt pile. Of course, nobody addresses it or tells us what we've been looking at. Tony hugs Susan, doesn't say anything about the table, which is rude. She's going to go home soon and find out that she can't eat. Like, the table's destroyed. Her window is just blown out. We get to see the Golden Gate Bridge, because by now we would have forgotten
that we're in San Francisco.
San Francisco.
And that's essential.
Yeah. They should have said The Manitou, A San Franciscan Tale. This is what the film should have been called. Tony is in a dope leather jacket. He's got like so many jackets in this movie. His jacket work is notable. Singing Rock and Tony hug and say goodbye.
Well, maybe we'll meet him again someday.
What are you talking about? He's dead.
The body's dead. Manitou lives on, remember?
And then we get a fact about a boy in 1969 in Japan that had a tumor in his chest that eventually grew into a fetus, and then the movie ends. Because how else do you want to end a movie about the Manitou than... what? It's just so bizarre. It's such a great end cap to a film that I think is so weird. And we could talk about that, let alone the tarot aspect, for hours, I would think. But unfortunately, we do have a limited amount of time. So do you have any final thoughts, things that we didn't touch on?
Yeah, I want to just talk for a minute about the fact that ultimately Karen...
yes.
Is able to channel some kind of...
I'm not sure.
Intense power. Power intense enough to at least temporarily defeat this incarnation of this creature and close up that portal or...
Yeah, Singing Rock screams something's like embodying her with power, imbuing her with power. I don't know what it is.
Exactly. Well, the fact... so she's topless, as you said. Yeah. It's almost like she's become this sort of Mother Earth sort of... I'm not really sure.
It makes me want to read the book.
Yeah, I wonder how that's explained.
There's just paragraphs that are like, laser blast, laser blast, laser blast. Because like,
there's definitely, there's something to that. Like, mm-hmm. What is it that they're trying to communicate with that? Or not trying to, but how can we read that? What is that saying?
Mm-hmm.
So she, in that moment, is more powerful than anything else.
Anything.
Or anyone else.
Two of the
involved.
Most strongest entities, and she's like vanquishing them.
So, I mean, I wonder if they are trying to suggest that it's yet another primal power that's trying to maintain.
Yeah. I don't know. That's probably
balance
book two.
In the universe or whatnot. But we cannot forget that what it keeps coming back to is that Miss Quamacus is attempting to enact revenge for what has happened to Native people.
He's really only a villain to her.
Well,
like, he hasn't done anything wrong to them.
No, I mean, we don't know what he would do if he were to be fully...
oh, I just meant as
reincarnated.
Well, it's even said, like, Tony's like, why her? And the guy's like, I think Burgess Meredith is like, I don't think it's personal. It's just a life form.
Yeah.
Which, I don't know. It's pretty great.
But, you know, in the end, the movie, at least, is on the side of...
Oh, very much so. Tony Curtis has to be the hero.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And of modernity.
He shouts into the void for, you know, his big contribution is like, hey, you stop it. And it's crazy.
Yeah. So this... It's a challenging film for me to watch in its politics, for sure.
Yeah. And again, I wonder what the book has to say.
Well, if the follow-up that you said in the series where Tony returns, if he's fighting a djinn...
Well, that's the fifth book.
It suggests that basically he's just... I don't know, traveling all around the world and defeating other cultures' magical beings.
It could
so
be.
I'm not down I with mean, that.
To bring it back to the other books the man wrote, he was talking about what women's dreams mean and how they could please their men. I don't know a lot about him, but I'm just saying there could be some problems there.
I might let you read those.
No, I'm not a I'm not going to collect those, but the Manitou books maybe. He should have wrote How to Please a Manitou. That would have been a book worth reading.
Well, we know that... Well, let's see. What is it? How do you please Manitou? I mean, I think the Manitou is just beyond it. And clearly, as we see with the machines, it doesn't enjoy being controlled.
That's true. You know what? My daughter has one of those If You Give a Mouse a Cookie books. So we should work on one called If You Give a Manitou a Vessel. And it'll just be about... how a shaman with a vessel, you know, then it's going to ask for whatever the next progression is. Like, I'll work on the outline.
Okay.
I'll get back to you on that. Which brings us to the section of questions at the very end of the episode, which pertain just to you.
Oh.
And the first of which is, are there any common misconceptions about either tarot or being an author or an artist or a writer? Because you are all of these things. So just whichever one speaks to you most in this moment.
Oh my gosh. That's a huge question.
Yeah, you have a lot of hats, so it makes it tricky.
I know. I'm trying to think, like...
We could keep it on tarot if you'd rather.
Yeah. I guess for all the things I do, it's hard to find, it's hard in contemporary times to take the amount of solitude and time that I need to create the way that I want to create. I talk about this a lot, especially in like classes with like creative classes with students. I'm at this point in my life and my career where I don't want to be a dabbler in anything. I want to be just all into these things.
Yeah.
And so I guess in terms of misconception, that like with a lot of people making decks today, I know for a fact that they haven't really studied the tarot. They just are interested in something that's become popular, and it is interesting to them. I don't doubt that, but I believe that if you're going to do a thing, you should really learn it. I think it's disrespectful otherwise. I think you can learn a system while drawing a deck, but you need to give it proper time, and I don't know.
I like that.
That's something that I think about a lot these days. And the misconception would be then that it's this easy thing and that you can just copy some existing deck and then, you know, in your own style, and that then that's going to make a usable tarot.
It's probably people that just comes explicitly from the design side.
Yes, I think so.
Yeah, where they're just like, I can design that. I can design whatever I want.
Yeah. Which is why historically you see so many duos, right? You see an artist and then an esotericist teaming up to make a deck.
That does make sense. What is a good day like for you?
A good day?
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. A good day is a day that is completely free of any kind of obligation or need to be anywhere, where I just can sit and work on projects, like, nonstop all day if I want to.
Yeah.
No interruptions. That's definitely a really, really good day.
And what is a bad day like?
A bad day is when I've over-obligated myself.
I get that.
Where I think I'm going to wake up and have coffee and just work on, you know, a new series or any of the things on the big list of upcoming projects that I want to get to. And then instead, the phone won't stop making noise, or I'm out of food and have to go to the store, or I, you know, have to suddenly pack a bunch of orders. Or not that I dislike orders. I don't dislike orders because I need to live.
Yeah.
I don't mean to say that. And I'm not trying to shirk responsibility. I just really... It's so frustrating to have a day where you think you're going to be able to exist only in the creative space.
Yeah.
And then practical things insert themselves.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
It's a real bummer.
Yeah.
Well, that brings us to my favorite question. Oh, no, before my favorite question.
I like these questions.
Do you have any advice for someone interested in tarot?
Oh, yeah. Interested in what sense? Interested in learning how to read or?
Yes.
Okay. Definitely what I'm always telling my students is multiple sources. You know, get a bunch of different books. Read a bunch of different books. Get a bunch of different styles of decks. Compare the imagery from one deck to the next. Look at how different artists from different eras have represented the cards. Look at how different decks are restructured. Well, restructure is not exactly the right word, but updated, right, to reflect contemporary ideas. Like, for instance...
The Black Panther one.
The Black Power one,
Black Power.
Also just within the tradition, you know, we expect certain names for certain cards, but there are a lot of issues in tarot being discussed recently about how the tarot is very gendered. So there are a lot of folks who in the past few years have been trying to make decks that deal with that. So not just about representing all different types of people and lifestyles, but taking out some of the gendered language as well, so that it's not kings and queens anymore, or emperor and empress, or hanged man, but so that it is a bit more neutralized, because tarot is meant to be for anyone,
right?
Yet is a system that does not always reflect that on its surface. So do a lot of those kind of comparisons. Find a deck that you see yourself in, that really speaks to you, that you can read intuitively with, and learn some basics of the system instead of memorizing. Like, look at patterns, learn those instead of just memorizing. Oh, this card means this. This card means that.
Yeah,
that's probably the best advice I'd have.
Nice. Which brings us to the last question, and it's my favorite question.
Okay.
Coleman Stevenson, what are your dreams like?
My actual literal dreams?
Yeah, like sleepy time.
Well, they are like movies.
Oh.
They are, well, I don't know if they are long. They feel long.
Yeah.
Like, sometimes I'll wake up in the middle of the night, in the middle of a dream, because I need to, you know, pee or something, and then go back to sleep. Go right back into the same
dream.
Whoa,
okay.
That happens quite often. But within that, they are extremely realistic.
Wow.
They often feature characters of people I know just playing themselves.
Wow. That's so weird.
Yeah. They're really real. So rarely fantasy stuff going on in my dreams. Although I do have a lot of those kind of, like in anxiety times, mm-hmm. if I'm feeling super stressed. Luckily, I haven't had that in a while, knock on wood.
That's good.
Those kind of dreams where you are so desperately trying to get somewhere, but your body won't work. So you're just dragging yourself.
Yeah.
Those happen a good bit. But yeah, for the most part, my dreams are just very, very real, with real things happening, with real people. Sometimes people are other people, or they don't look like themselves, but quite often they just are themselves.
That's so funny.
And I'm just living real life again while I'm asleep.
Yeah.
I wish I could say that amazing things. The best thing that happens in dreams is that I'll write poems, or I'll be making visual art.
Yeah.
And then, of course, it's the problem upon waking of, do I still have that in my mind enough that I can take notes and capture the thing, because I made it.
Right.
So it's very frustrating when I wake up and it's elusive
fading.
And I can't get it. And it's the best thing I've ever made.
Yeah. Oh, gosh. Wow. Well, thank you so much for coming. I really appreciate you watching The Manitou.
I watched it twice.
Thank you. And thank you for sharing just, again, what we've been talking about is just a tiny, tiny little sliver of something like tarot. We couldn't really get into the nitty-gritty of something like that in full respect, shall we say. But you teach classes?
I do, here and there, yeah. I have been doing some tarot classes independently at various places around town. And then I fairly regularly teach a really interesting tarot class through Literary Arts Delve series. In fact, we're in the middle of it right now.
Oh, cool.
It takes place at the Portland Art Museum. And we learn basics of tarot reading. And then we also go into the museum collections and talk about visual motifs and how that connects to tarot.
And how do people find that?
Motifs.
It's just through the...
Yeah, they would look up Literary Arts Delve, D-E-L-V-E, okay. Seminars.
And then your classes are... how do people find out about those?
Oh, the other ones? Oh, probably just following on Instagram.
Okay, great.
I always advertise if I'm going to do any kind of a pop-up class.
Dark Exact.
Dark Exact.
Great. Perfect. Well, again, thank you.
Thanks.
It's lovely to have you here.
I hope we did justice to discussing this complicated film.
I think we did.
Okay.
Thank you.